Yes.
Okay.
Ooh. All right, ladies and gentlemen. You're hearing the Neutron Dance, written in the instrumental in the background, written by one of our guests tonight, Allie Willis. Very excited to have her on.
I just want to drive a truck and just smash shit through Detroit right now.
Is that what happens in Beverly Hills Cop?
Yes, beginning of it.
Talk.
Come to home. Hello.
Hi, Allie. It's Corey.
Hey. How are you?
Is it okay? Is it okay if I put you right on the air?
Let me see. Well, I'll give it my best go.
Okay. I'm putting you on the air in 3, 2, 1. You're on the air. Allie Willis. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Let me introduce people who you are if people don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, on our phone right now, I am really, really excited to have the multidisciplinary artist, the Detroit native visual artist, and the Grammy-winning songwriter, internet. Her good friend Lily Tomlin once called her the greatest artist of our time or any other. Allie Willis is on our phone right now. Can you guys believe I got Allie Willis on the phone?
No, I must clear up that Lily Tomlin quote that you just did.
Okay.
She actually called my alter ego Bubbles the Artist. Yeah, Bubbles.
Okay.
The greatest artist ever.
Bubbles is your alter ego.
And Bubbles the Artist was a really bad artist in the greatest sense of the word, which I know you understand.
I do. Well, was Bubbles a visual artist, correct? No, because you had
Bubbles was also a multimedia artist. Mainly, it started with paintings where, oh my God, I have to tell someone I'm on the radio.
Do your thing.
I'm on the radio. I gotta call you back. All right, I'm here.
Thank you.
Bubbles started where she did 100 paintings in 2 months.
Nice.
And I had an auction in my backyard where we hung the paintings up on clothespins. And she sold 92 of them, and then from then on did copy paintings and ended up selling like thousands of paintings. Now, these were only going for like $50 to $150, but it supported me while writing The Color Purple. So there is some significance there.
But
Bubbles is a tragically bad artist, and also did videos and ceramics and a bunch of other stuff.
But
you can certainly go to bubblestheartist.com or get to her through my website.
Let me ask you this, Allie. One of my favorite pieces of anything ever is the show Just Say Julie, starring Julie Brown, that was on MTV.
Absolutely.
I have the two DVDs that are available, and I watch them obsessively, and I laugh, and I'm just so I'm taken to another place when I look at that set which you designed, which is incredible.
Oh, it's beyond design. It was the whole deal with that. We were really good friends. We still are.
Okay.
And I'm
a huge fan of that show and your work on that show.
Great. Well, I love that because most people don't even know that show. But it was actually the very first clip show on MTV.
Right, before Beavis and Butthead, she would laugh at the videos, yeah.
Yeah, well, so she, we would shoot 10 episodes in 3 days, and we did that 3 times a year. And my salary was only $500 for the whole thing. And I did every single visual thing that you saw there. But the deal was that I could keep anything that I bought or designed for the set. So I still have every single inch of everything, plus some of the stuff was straight out of my house.
Oh, my God. Well, I want to talk about your house in a little bit. And, I mean, there's way too much to cover of your – I mean, I am a huge fan of you, so it's crazy. But let me just try to burn through what I can. So do you believe in synchronicity at all? Ms. Willis.
Oh, that's my life. Yes,
it is?
Absolutely.
Well, check this out. Yes. Last night I was in the club and I was dancing, right? and I was getting my drink on and I was dancing. And what comes blasting over the radio? I swear to God, not the radio, the DJ spun it. And not only, it wasn't only audio, it was a video of this song. Was the Pet Shop Boys with Dusty Springfield, What Have I Done to Deserve This, started blasting.
Oh, absolutely.
And I started yelling at everyone on the dance floor, like, the woman that wrote this is on my show tomorrow, and no one believed me.
Yes.
But you wrote that song,
well,
didn't you?
Well, I am here. I am here in the flesh. Yes, we wrote that. That's actually a pretty good story in terms of my multimedia-ness. I had just started to paint. Now, this was Allie who started painting.
Not Bubbles.
About 15 years
before Bubbles. Oh, well, that was my question. Do we see any of the Bubbles work on the set of Just Say Julie, or that's all Allie, right?
That's all Allie, but I would say psychologically that was the beginning of Bubbles, because that was my first serious embracing of kitsch.
Mm-hmm.
After really being much more into... mainly 50s and 60s and 70s, ultra, ultra modern, and, you know, design, clothing, music, anything. So,
yeah.
Should I go back to Pet Shop Boys?
Yeah, can you tell us the Pet Shop Boys story. Come on.
All right, so Pet Shop Boys, I had just started painting. I was unbelievably bored with songwriting. I was getting over 100 records cut a year. So this was like in my absolute heyday. But the process of writing was getting very dull to me. People, you know, kind of wanted the same song, which for me is always boring. I was getting asked to write a lot of lyrics. I think because of Earth, Wind, and Fire, people assumed I was just lyrics, which was never the case. It was always both. But I was getting on so many records, and when you do them with, you know, just lyrics, you kind of plow through them fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really losing my spirit musically, and in a very synchronistic night, I ended up staying up painting all night, and I was working with one of the Go-Go's at that point. She walked in the next day and bought the painting.
Okay.
So I kept painting, and my publisher put up some of my very first paintings in her office. Pet Shop Boys manager, when West End Girls came out and was a huge hit in Europe, looking for a publishing contract for them here. So he goes to interview with my publisher, sees the paintings, and I get hired to go to London to paint their portrait for their fan club stationery.
Whoa.
Yeah, and it was while they were posing for me, and I use that term loosely if you ever see this portrait. they said, well, why don't we know your art? And I said, you know, I just started painting. I'm really a songwriter, but we never really talked about what I did. And
right.
Then Neil, the lead singer, who's really not knowledgeable about music,
uh-huh.
just almost as a joke said, you're not that A. Willis on all those Earth, Wind, and Fire records, are you? And it was like, yeah. So then I stayed, and then during the next week, we wrote and demoed What Have I Done to Deserve.
So that, your visual art got you the Pet Shop Boys gig, basically. That's
yeah, crazy. that was the first time that.
And that, whose suggestion? What I mean, did you know Dusty Springfield was going to be involved, or was that just a later thing?
Well, no, I had written for Dusty and was friends with her.
Okay.
And they were her biggest fans on the planet. So as soon as we wrote the chorus, and that was a melody that I had been toying with for a bunch of times, and it just seemed to fit there. They said, boy, this would be great as a duet with Dusty. But Dusty Springfield hated the record industry, hated, never wanted to do anything again. So we both worked on her. Ultimately, it was them who finally convinced her. And then it ended up being her second biggest record ever, next to Son of a Preacher Man.
You know, I watched it on the big screen last night at the club, and she looks absolutely beautiful and sounds amazing on that record. It was like she was kind of like in prime form, you know?
Yeah, she was. That was a truly an exceptional musical being.
So, okay, you mentioned Earth, Wind, and Fire, and I haven't revealed this to our listeners who don't know who you are. But so in the year is 1974 in New York, and our guest, Allie Willis, if you just tuned in, you know, she released this great record that's kind of like it's in the, it's, if please don't be mad at me for comparing you to other artists, but for you know, people our age, it was kind of in that James Taylor, Carole King-esque singer-songwriter vein, which is so great.
Yeah.
It's called Child Star, right? I just discovered it.
And
so, how did oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, those were the first 10 songs I ever wrote.
Well, how did a white girl that had a singer-songwriter gig end up writing two of the funkiest songs of all time, September and Boogie Wonderland for Earth, Wind, and Fire?
I grew up in Detroit, and there's your answer right there.
There it is. All right, so we're moving on now. So
yeah.
This gig of...
No, you know, Detroit, and then the years that Motown was coming up. So to this day, I've never, ever learned how to play... or read or notate music, but I hear every single note in my head.
You have good. So, you hear the right key in your head, which is that's kind of a rare thing. You have a good ear.
Yeah, no, I hear like exact.
Know who else didn't? Who had a perfect pitch and didn't read music was Prince. Did you ever have any encounters with him?
Did I ever? Very first time now that we're speaking about Earth, Wind, and Fire, it was September had just come out. That was my very first hit, and that thing was huge. And
it's still huge. I hear it on the radio every day. It's the hugest.
No, it literally gets bigger every year. It's one of those few songs that I am most blessed to have co-written. That it literally every single year gets bigger, 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 bigger. So, unbelievable.
So Earth, Wind, and Fire, you encountered Prince through them somehow?
Yeah. So Prince was an Earth, Wind, and Fire fanatic. And actually signed with their manager, and they, at that point, they owned a record company, which was a subsidiary of Columbia, which then became Sony. And so everyone was up in that office. So I came up the very first day to hear the album that was coming out right after September was released, to hear it sequenced. And I wrote all but two songs on that album. And I was still collecting food stamps and getting, you know, medical assistance. So I was still a completely starving songwriter. So all of this stuff was so surreal that this just kind of exploded. And so I go up to hear the album sequence. I know it's going to be an emotional experience, and I really want to hear it alone. And I go into Maurice's office, and I'm shutting the door, and one of my friends who, you know, worked there kind of stuck her arm in the door, and she said, and she just said the kid. We used to call him the kid. Listen to this with you. And it was just this odd, like, little guy always wearing, like, short shorts, and, you know, fishnet tops, never would look you in the eye, never talk to you. So I'm like, no, I don't want this kid listening. You know, this is, like, my big moment,
yeah.
And I already know this guy has, like, no personality. Anyway, so, but I couldn't say no because he was like standing there like a drooling pit bull. So I, you know, let this guy listen to this album that was literally about to change my life with me. And then 4 months later, when I Want to Be Your Lover came out, I knew that I got to share that with Prince. So yeah. It was unbelievable. And then the only other time we were both named Dangerous Subversives by Pravda, which was the communist government's newspaper.
You were on that list?
Well, he got named for Purple Rain, which they said was synonymous with nuclear fallout.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it for Neutron Dance,
right?
That's right. Which they said that I poisoned the minds of youth by preaching the inevitability of nuclear war. And then they mistranslated it as neutron bomb.
Oh, my God. All right. So that's what an amazing story. Holy shit. So, okay. You had, of course, you turned. So we're moving. I mean, you went on to write for Earth, Wind, and Fire. You hit it big, huge again with that Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack, which everyone knows was the biggest thing in the world.
Have it on record, man.
Yeah, everyone had it on record.
It really defines what a movie soundtrack has.
Do you have a lot of respect for the Pointer Sisters?
Yeah, I love them. I love working with them. You know, I love every time I see them still. Mm-hmm. So yeah, girls.
Yeah, and they're like deep. They go super deep with the funk and the soul, and they did the Herbie Hancock tracks, and they had a lot of turmoil. They're an interesting story. All right, I'm burning through this. I'm sorry, Allie.
As listeners might remember, the Pointer Sisters were my first concert ever at 4 years old at
Disneyland.
That's
right. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Well, so,
they were wonderful.
Great. You were in L.A. at this time, and you were in L.A. in my dream scene, the scene I wish I was partying in. You were partying with people like Elvira, Pee-wee, Paul Rubens, Leslie Ann Warren, yeah. Who's your friend. I'm imagining there were some John Waters and Russ Meyer people around, probably.
There were John Waters people. Like, I was really good friends with Mick Stoll,
yeah.
But never met John Waters. And Russ Meyer, I know this will absolutely make you choke. Not only was I friends with at least three quarters of them, but I hosted a Beyond the Valley of the Dolls party here with the original cast.
How do I party with you? I want to party.
Now,
all right.
And I'm sure there's photos of that online. And the only ones in attendance were every living member of the cast.
Whoa.
Suzanne Perry, who was there, still manages probably all of them. So everyone from, like, Tura, I mean, all the way down.
Oh, I love
John,
her.
Who was the crazy guy in there. And then my only outside guest, and I know you guys will know people, RuPaul.
Yes.
Pamela DeBar.
Yes. Oh, Miss Pat, we had Pamela DeBar on the show a couple years ago.
Oh, I love, that's one of my closest friends.
Oh, he's the, and, oh, God, I love these guys.
MacGyver.
Cassandra, you know, Elvira.
Yeah.
And I think Paul Rubens, and that was it. So that was some incredible party.
Let me ask you if these people are around, just the lightning around really quick. Were these people around back then? Judy Tenuta and Emo Phillips. Do you remember them at all?
I had nothing. I remember them, but they weren't in my circle.
Okay, what about Oingo Boingo people or Devo people?
The people in my, definitely not me.
Okay. Was Phil Hartman ever around Pee-wee?
yeah, a lot.
All right. So you guys, after this, I mean, her career gets crazier the farther you go along. But you did work on the Howard the Duck soundtrack, right?
Well, of course, I never tell anyone that.
Yeah, we don't have to go into too much detail.
But did you have issues when you saw the duck fornicating with a human when you saw the movie?
Wait, I can't tell you. Did I have issues with the duck?
Well, no. Here's the thing. Here. Let me. I'll ask you a more general question. Tell me about the feeling, just real quick, about before it came out, and then once you saw the movie, did you feel differently? You know, just was there like a big anticipation? Because George Lucas directed it, and that was like, you know. Huge.
Well, no, George Lucas produced it. If George Lucas directed it, we would not be having this conversation.
Okay,
but,
yeah.
I got asked to write it because I was good friends and worked with Thomas Dolby. He was.
Oh, you are? I think Thomas Dolby is. An utter genius. I think he's a super genius.
Yeah, really great. A great guy, too. Yeah. So he was scoring the film, and he told them that the only way he would score the film is if he also got to write the songs. And then on the songs, he brought in me and George Clinton. And
wait, George Clinton, the funk guy, or George S. Clinton, the music composer?
No, funk guy.
Okay.
Parliament Funkadelic.
Yes,
the three of us wrote Howard the Duck, and then me and Howard wrote three more songs in there, and then there's some other person that I didn't know who did one with
I know you know this. I know you know this because
I thought the movie would. I thought the movie would be disastrous once I went up to San Francisco and was on the set, because I took one look at the duck and thought this will never fly, so to speak. So, I was not surprised.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how things like that do become cult classics. So. A song that I thought absolutely no one knew. It's only really been the last few months for some reason. I guess because there's like a Blu-ray that's supposed to come out where, you know, people that know me are going, oh, my God, you wrote Howard the Duck. So I have a few songs like that that I'm not aware that people even knew that evidently were really well known.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that. Shelby, if you could mute yourself, if you can for a second. But
are you getting noise?
Yeah, just I think it's like, yeah, just for a second. But you don't have
to. Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I was going to say, like, of course you know, because you're with it and you're hip and you know what's kitschy, that Howard the Duck has totally developed a cult audience and people love the songs from it. It's kind of crazy. But, yeah. All right. So you did Howard the Duck.
Well, they do love the song. I get, you know, my standards, because I feel like I was one of the first people who ever kind of put their life on the line for, you know, bad films. I had a really serious bad film club called Elysian de Cinema, the dog cinema.
Was there anyone in the club that we'd recognize?
Yeah, all the suspects that have been named already.
Okay, got it.
That was the heart of it. And I would spray paint milk bones. I'd spray paint them gold, and I'd put them in little doggy bags. And then either at my house, which was built as the party house for MGM, or if there was an especially horrendous film that we knew was going to be bad coming out, we would actually go to the theater. And then everyone would get the, you know, one doggy bag. And then at the end of the film, before we left the theater, so you didn't have a chance to talk to anyone, you'd have to put your bones in. So it was, you know, a one boner being the worst and a five boner being, you know, the best. And so those movies, though, Howard the Duck had good production values. So we really loved films where they just, you know, someone gently closed the door and the whole room shook, you mm-hmm. know. That was kind of so I never realized that Howard the Duck, it just had crap status. It didn't have cult status. But I understand now definitely cult status. So I guess I need to look at it again and see if I could possibly see it through those eyes.
You don't have to. No, I'm just kidding. So I just want to talk about a couple more music things, and then I just want to talk about your house and then what you're working on now real quick before I let you go. And I really just thank you so much for coming on. Like, as soon as
I love that you're so educated.
Well, as soon as I discovered the same woman that did my, I'm like, who is the woman that did my favorite visual art that's ever been on TV? The Just Say Julie wow. set. And once I realized it was the woman that wrote some of my favorite songs, you know, I mean, my mind was really blown, and I just wanted to talk
that's
to you.
Right.
So, okay, so another bit of synchronicity for me is that one of my favorite bands growing up was Fishbone, and then. I still see them and I still know them. And you wrote a song for Fishbone, and the song you wrote, I remember they used to play it live, and it was called "I'm a Weed Plant." Did you change it?
No, that wasn't me.
Okay, it wasn't you.
Although
did you ever work with Fishbone at all?
Yes. Now, when I say the only one I'm aware I wrote, because I was writing with so many people that a lot of time people say stuff to me and I go, no, that absolutely wasn't me. And then they show me the record and it was. But to the best of my memory, it's true. To the best of my memory, I only did one song with them. It was in the early 90s, I think. And it was called "Where'd You Get Those Pants?"
Yeah, okay, so it was called "Where'd You Get Those Pants?" But they used to play it before they released it as that called "I'm a Weed Plant." But they didn't.
Oh.
Yeah, and then someone changed it to "Where'd You Get Those Pants?" Are you the one that wrote those lyrics?
Must have been
That's
me.
That's crazy.
We wrote them together, but yes, no, I was definitely driving.
So
the
you worked with Angelo Moore. Any memories of that at all, or no?
I really liked him a lot, and my friend Steve Lindsay, I think, was either producing them or they were somehow signed to him. And Steve was someone I worked with a lot before, so I think it was the three of us. But I got along great with him. He lived really near me. We had very similar tastes, even though we had never actually met before.
Yeah, he's from the Valley, like me. I'm a Valley kid, you know.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, cool, so. Allie. Hold on. Oh, they're in a great kitschy movie. One of the kitsch classics I think you'd love. You've probably seen it before, but you should revisit it someday. It's called Back to the Beach with Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello.
Yeah, again, those pictures, they get to the production values are too good for me.
Oh, yeah, it's not lo-fi enough for you, right?
Yeah. No, I need them really bad. But I remember that. I think I was supposed to be writing music for that and then didn't.
I knew you were involved somehow because that screams your name. All right. So if everyone doesn't know out there, Allie Willis, our current guest who's on the show right now, a visual artist, owns the Museum of Kitsch in L.A., which is legendary, and is working on all new stuff and wrote all these great songs. She wrote the theme to Friends, I'll Be There For You.
Yeah.
Wow. That'll blow you. How big is that's the biggest song in the world, yeah. Right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about your house real quick. Your house is basically what we all, every dorky dude that listens to this show, and woman, wishes their house was your house. You have the literal Pee-wee's Playhouse, Just Say Julie house. You live in it.
Yeah.
It's called the Museum of Kitsch. It's in Los Angeles. It's not open to the public, though, right?
Well, no. It's actually, though, my house, because it's in the house. The Allie Willis Museum of Kitsch was actually an online museum, and it was built as a kind of social network around collectors or purveyors of a kind of almost like a certain point of view that was then reflected in the way they lived, they dressed, whatever. And I no longer curate that. I used to put up 10 new things a day, one of which would be mine, but 9 would be from other people who were putting stuff up. But that still survives as literally the single largest collection of kitsch on the planet. And that's at awmok.com, AWMOK, which is the Allie Willis Museum of Kitsch.
Is it true, so where you keep all this stuff, is it true that in your will you said you want this place preserved after you pass away?
Yes. I have to go a little deeper with it and think it out better, but yes, that's in there. Not a paper touched. So the house, though, is actually called Willis Wonderland after Boogie Wonderland.
Oh.
And, but I've kind of given in to people thinking that it is the actual Museum of Kitsch. So I answer yes to both of those.
And then
I also have I have the whole bottom of a fourplex as well that I have everything else in that isn't in the house.
I'm gonna come to your house one day. You're gonna let me in, okay?
So. Take your Valium first.
I know, I'm a big buffalo. I just like break. Okay, never mind. All right, so you're still performing. You just did this. Did you ever complete the Detroit project that you were working on?
I'm in the midst of that right now.
I heard that there was over 500 vocal tracks you put on this thing. 5,000? 5,000 vocal tracks?
500? Are you kidding?
I mean, who are you? Are you Brian Wilson on acid? Wait, Brian Wilson was on acid.
It was 5,000 vocal tracks, each with 10 to 250 voices on them. There's nothing of this scope has ever been done before. I took 2 microphones and I went to Detroit, which is my hometown, and this was 2013. I was completely sick of what everyone was saying about Detroit. And the thing about Detroit that is so spectacular is the people there and that spirit that started with probably from before Motown, but, you know, just this rhythm is there, this incredible design sense is there. And the people of the city were never, not only were they shafted, you know, by the city government.
Yeah.
But even now in the way that people talk about Detroit coming back, they're talking about all the building going on. They're talking about the artists moving in.
Allie,
ignoring the people.
Do you respect Jack White for what he's done for the city at all or no?
No. I love anyone who stays there and, you know, puts their money where their mouth is. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see more, but yeah. But anyway, so I went back in a series of 60 sing-alongs, 60, all over the city. I recorded anyone who wanted to sing or play on this record, this song I wrote for Detroit. So it's more people in history than have ever been on a record before. And it's a matching video because it was a way for me to get my multimedia-ness in. So certainly doesn't look like anything anyone's expecting. So now I just finished. It took 2 years to go everything because it's all me. And then at times, you know, up to one other collaborator. So there were over 20,000 hours of footage and over 5,000 tracks. So
damn,
this is a massive project. So I just finished. Now I have to figure out how to release it, how to promote it, and how to have the greatest fucking premiere ever in Detroit.
This
and
is
you
like,
know I have a reputation for throwing parties. So.
This is like your pet sounds. This is like your grand masterwork, huh?
My problem is, though, I'm as aggressive as it gets in the work itself. I know nothing when it comes to really getting it out there. I don't know how I ever have had a...
Well, hey, I'll play it on a logical contraption. I promise you'll get at least 4 sales on iTunes from it. I promise.
Well, thank you very much. Definitely. So I'm doing that. And then, you know, I have a show on Broadway, right?
You're still... Well, you wrote The Color Purple on Broadway.
But you're still,
which is huge. You're still, are you friends with Oprah?
She produces the show. I'm not friends with her, but I got,
you don't get invited to the parties.
No, I'm a Poe Appalachian cousin. Yeah.
Allie, you're still performing, yeah, right? You still do maybe a poetry reading or a song here and there throughout LA.
Yes, though that's not what I do. I just started performing a few years ago and, I approach it like a party host because that's what I think my best skill is. So it's everything. I do all the greatest hits of sing-alongs. I tell, you know, stories, you know, similar to what we're talking here, but they're dirtier. And very multimedia, you know, multimedia show. I have thrift shop auctions, you know, kitsch auctions. You can win, you know, foot massages during, like, the most sensitive ballad. So stuff like that goes on.
I mean, Allie Willis has done it all. She's written songs for beyond what we talked about. Also, Boy George and Patti LaBelle, Pamplemousse, that band that's from the internet. Toto, the Pecaro. You worked with the Pecaro brothers. Oh my God.
Much more recently, but we were we were friends. We all kind of came up at the same time.
Well, I wish I had more time to talk to you, but I would love to interview you in person sometime, Ms. Willis. And
all right,
you are amazing.
You'll get your trip to the Willis Wonderland.
Ah, I couldn't even imagine. Thank you for all you've done to bring joy to the world in my life, and just I can't. I think your body of work is just outstanding, and it means the world to everybody. I think you're the best.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're
and,
welcome.
Thank you.
Do you have any memories, real quick, or any words to say about one of our favorite guests who was on our show one day? He gave us a 45-minute interview, and he was so great. Taylor Negron. Did you ever party with that guy?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Definitely was great friends with him. He was great friends with my friend April Winchell. Do you know her?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I do know who April Winchell is. Yeah,
yeah. Because if you were into Julie Brown, you really needed to see the Sheila Sands show, and that was April. So, Taylor, I definitely hung with. We did a bunch of shows together.
God, if I could be a fly on the wall
really
back then, at your parties. Allie, can I get?
He was a regular party guest, definitely.
Can I get, before you go, can I get an ID? Can you say this is Allie Willis and you're listening to Illogical Contraption Radio? Is that okay?
Yes, if I can manage to get that out.
Okay, it's called Illogical Contraption.
Contraption, right. Illogical, okay.
Okay.
And I'm calling it the Illogical Contraption Radio Show?
Yes.
Okay. All right, ready to roll?
3, 2, 1.
Hello, this is Allie Boogie Wonderland Willis, and I am listening to the Illogical Contraption Radio Show.
Thank you, Allie, and thank you, Bubbles.
All right.
Bye, Bubbles.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, Bubbles, you send your best.
Yeah, all right. That's awesome. That's one of my favorite people,
wow.
I think, and celebs. I love a celeb that does it all, you know?
I mean, and her body of work has impacted all of us, especially
the Friends
when we were
song.
Kids. Well, I'm just thinking, like, just the visual artist stuff of doing the Julie Brown set.
Yeah, and, dude, you got to borrow those DVDs. I'll let you borrow them. They are nonstop funny.
I haven't seen them since I was a kid.
She strikes
so
me as someone who would kick it with, like, say, Elton John and then some, like, janky ass piano player in the same day. And
no, exactly, like, right? Like, she lives the way
she's cool to everyone.
She lives the way me and you do, Al. Me and you, we go to the penthouse of the Sunset Marquee, and then we're drinking in the gutter.
Corey does have that stripper pole in his apartment, though.
Structure support.
Sorry.
All right, we're going to take
1982 artificial turf at my house.
We're going to take a really quick break, and then we're going to call Patty Greer and Shelby Lermo. Sarah Murphy, you hanging in there? You doing
I'm
okay?
I'm hanging in. Yeah, this has been so great. I want to start a bad movie club, like the one Allie Willis was talking about.
I know. I bet she knows our future guest, Ann Magnuson, too. I didn't even ask her. God damn it. All right, we'll be right back.